Be afraid. Be very afraid. This is Global Dimming, the audio from a movie made for the BBC on September the 18th, 2006.
And investigates a newly discovered climatic phenomenon with potentially catastrophic results.
This is a film that demands action. It reveals that we may have grossly underestimated the speed at which our climate is changing. At its heart is a deadly new phenomenon. One that until very recently, scientists refused to believe even existed. But it may already have led to the starvation of millions. Tonight, Horizon examines for the first time the power of what scientists are calling global dimming. September the 12th, 2001, the aftermath of tragedy. While America mourned, the weather all over the country was unusually fine. ...800 miles west of New York, in Madison, Wisconsin, a climate scientist called David Travis was on his way to work.
Around the 12th, later on in the day, when I was driving to work, and I noticed how bright blue and clear the sky was. And at first I didn't think about it, and then I realized the sky was unusually clear.
For 15 years, Travis had been researching an apparently obscure topic: whether the vapor trails left by aircraft were having a significant effect on the climate. In the aftermath of 9/11, the entire US fleet was grounded. And Travis finally had a chance to find out.
It was certainly, you know, one of the tiny positives that may have come out. It was an opportunity to do research that hopefully will never happen again.
Travis suspected that the grounding might make a small but detectable change to the climate. But what he observed was both immediate and dramatic.
We found that the change in temperature range during those 3 days was just over 1°C. And you have to realize that from a layman's perspective, that doesn't sound like much, but from a climate perspective, that is huge.
One degree in just 3 days. No one had ever seen such a big climatic change happen so fast. This was a new kind of climate change. Scientists call it global dimming. 2 years ago, most of them had never even heard of it. Yet now they believe it may mean all their predictions about the future of our climate could be wrong. The trail that would lead to the discovery of global dimming began 40 years ago in Israel with the work of a young English immigrant called Jerry Stanhill. A trained biologist, Jerry got a job helping to design irrigation schemes. His task was to measure how strongly the sun shone over Israel.
It was important for this work to measure solar radiation because that is a factor that basically determines how much water crops require.
For a year, Jerry collected data from a network of light meters. The results were much as expected and were used to help design the national irrigation system. 20 years later, in the 1980s, Jerry decided to repeat his measurements to check that they were still valid. What he found stunned him.
Well, I was amazed to find that there was a very serious reduction in sunlight, the amount of sunlight in Israel. In fact, if we compare those very early measurements in the 1950s with the current measurements, there was a staggering 22% drop in the sunlight, and that really amazed me.
A 22% drop in solar energy was simply massive. If it was true, surely Israelis should be freezing. There had to be something wrong. So when Jerry published his results, they were ignored.
I must say that the publications had almost no effect whatsoever on the scientific community.
But in fact, Jerry was not the only scientist who had noticed a fall in sunlight. In Germany, a young graduate climatologist called Beata Liepert found that the same thing seemed to be happening over the Bavarian Alps too.
I was the same, I was as skeptical as any other climatologist, but then I saw the same results in Germany, so I believed in
it. Germany, Israel, what about the rest of the world? Working independently of each other, Liepert and Stanhill began searching through publications, journals and meteorological records from around the world. And they both found the same extraordinary story. Between the 1950s and the early 1990s, the level of solar energy reaching the Earth's surface had dropped 9% in Antarctica, 10% in the USA, by almost 30% in Russia, and by 16% in parts of the British Isles. This was a truly global phenomenon, and Jerry gave it a suitable name. Global dimming. But again, the response from other scientists was one of sheer disbelief.
The scientific community was obviously not ready to deal with the fact that there was a global dimming phenomena.
Of course, there was good reason for the skepticism. Less energy from the sun should be making the world cooler. Yet scientists knew the Earth was getting hotter, as the carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases we emit trap ever more heat in the Earth's atmosphere and cause global warming.
My friend's reaction, and actually to Jerry's and to my work at the same time too, was, oh my God, this is really extreme. You are contradicting global warming. Do you know how many billions of dollars are spent on global warming research, and you and this old guy are contradicting us?
So Liepert and Stanhill's work was widely dismissed. But global dimming was not the only phenomenon that didn't seem to fit with global warming. In Australia, two more biologists, Michael Roderick and Graham Farquhar, were intrigued by another paradoxical result: the worldwide decline in something called the pan evaporation rate.
It's called pan evaporation rate because it's evaporation rate for pan. every day, all over the world, people come out in the morning and see how much water they've got to add to a pan to bring it back to the level it was at the same time the morning before. It's that simple.
In some places, agricultural scientists have been performing this rather dull daily task for more than 100 years.
The long-term measurements of pan evaporation are what give it its real value.
And the fact that they're doing the same thing day in, day out with the same instrument.
Yeah, they deserve a medal, each of them.
Yeah.
For decades, nobody took much notice of the pan evaporation measurements. But in the 1990s, scientists spotted something very strange. The rate of evaporation was falling.
There is a paradox here about the fact that the pan evaporation rate's going down, an apparent paradox, but the global temperature's going up.
This was a puzzle. Most scientists reasoned that, like a pan on the stove, turning up the global temperature should increase the rate at which water evaporated. But Roderick and Farquhar did some calculations and worked out that temperature was not the most important factor in pan evaporation.
Well, it turns out, in fact, that the key things for pan evaporation are the sunlight, the humidity, and the wind. But really, the sunlight is a really dominant term there.
They found that it was the energy of the photons hitting the surface, the actual sunlight, that kicks the water molecules out of the pan and into the atmosphere. And so they too reached an extraordinary conclusion.
You know, if the pan is going down, then maybe that's the sunlight going down.
Was the fall in pan evaporation, in fact, evidence of global dimming? Somewhere in the journals, they felt, must be the hard numbers that could tie the two things together.
And then one day, just by accident, I had to go to the library to get an article out of Nature. And I, as you do, I couldn't find it. And I just glanced at through the thing, and there was an article called Evaporation Losing Its Strength, which reported a decline in pan evaporation over Russia, United States, and Eastern Europe. And there, in the measurements, they said that the pans had, on average, evaporated about 100 millimetres less of water in the last 30 years.
Mike knew how much sunlight was needed to evaporate a millimetre of water. So he put the two sets of figures together, the drop in evaporation with the drop in sunlight.
So you just do the sum in your head. 100 millimetres of water, less of pan evaporation, 2.5 megajoules, so 2.5 times 100 is 250 megajoules. And that was in fact what the Russians had measured for the decline in sunlight in the last 30 years. It was quite amazing.
It was the same with Europe and the USA. The drop in evaporation rate matched exactly the drop in sunlight reported by Beata Lippert and Jerry Stanhill. Two completely independent sets of observations had come to the same conclusion. Though it seemed incredible, there was no doubting global dimming now.
All in a sudden, you see, oh my God, the world is dimming. And then all in a sudden you see, oh my God, this really has a tremendous impact.
And it had to be dimming in Europe, and in America, and in Russia,
This is on a global scale, and we thought this is really important because the amount of dimming was enormous. So this is big on a global scale.
But what was causing it? Scientists knew that there was nothing wrong with the sun itself. The culprit had to be here on Earth. And as they searched for clues, they would make another startling discovery. Global dimming is a killer. It may have been behind the worst climatic disaster of recent times, responsible for famine and death on a biblical scale. And global dimming is poised to strike again. Maldives, a nation of 1,000 tiny islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean, so recently battered by the Asian tsunami. It was here that Veerabhadran Ramanathan, one of the world's leading climate scientists, began to unravel the mystery of what's causing global dimming. He had first noticed declining sunlight over large areas of the Pacific Ocean in the mid-1990s.
But we didn't know at that time it was part of a much larger global picture. But I knew we had to find out what was causing that.
Ramanathan was certain of one thing. The big drop in sunlight reaching the ground had to be something to do with changes in the Earth's atmosphere. There was one obvious suspect.
Almost anything we do to create energy causes pollution.
Burning fuel doesn't just produce the invisible greenhouse gases which cause global warming. It also produces visible pollution. Tiny airborne particles of soot and other pollutants. These produce the haze which shrouds our cities. So Ramanathan wondered, could this pollution be causing global dimming? The Maldives were the perfect place to find out. The Maldives seem unpolluted, but for much of the year, the northern islands sit in a stream of dirty air descending from India. Only the southern tip of the Long Island chain enjoys clean air, coming all the way from Antarctica. So, by comparing the northern islands with the southern ones, Ramanathan and his colleagues would be able to see exactly what difference the pollution made to the atmosphere and the sunlight.
You're listening to the audio soundtrack of Global Dimming, a movie made for the BBC and presented on September the 18th, 2006.
Project INDOX, as it was called, was a huge multinational effort. For 4 years, every possible technique was used to sample and monitor the atmosphere over the Maldives. INDOX cost $25 million, but it produced results, and they surprised everyone.
The stunning part of the experiment was this pollutant layer, which was about 3 kilometers thick, cut down the sunlight reaching the ocean by more than 10%.
A 10% fall in sunlight meant that particle pollution was having a far bigger effect than anyone had thought possible.
Our models led us to believe the human impact on the dimming was close to half to 1%. So what we discovered was tenfold.
INDOX showed that the pollution particles were blocking some sunlight themselves. But far more significant was what they were doing to the clouds. They were turning them into giant mirrors. Clouds are made of droplets of water. These only form when water vapor in the atmosphere starts to condense on the surface of naturally occurring airborne particles, typically pollen or sea salt. As they grow, the water droplets eventually become so heavy they fall as rain. Ramanathan found the polluted air contained far more particles than the unpolluted air. Particles of ash, soot, and sulfur dioxide.
We saw 10 times more particles in the polluted air mass north of the Maldives compared with what we saw south of the Maldives, which was a pristine air mass.
In the polluted air, billions of man-made particles provided 10 times as many sites around which water droplets could form. So polluted clouds contained many more water droplets, each one far smaller than it would be naturally. Many small droplets reflect more light than fewer big ones. So the polluted clouds were reflecting more light back into space, preventing the heat of the sun getting through. This was the cause of global dimming.
Basically, the global dimming we saw in the North Indian Ocean, it was contributed on the one hand by the particles themselves shielding the ocean from the sunlight, on the other hand, making the clouds brighter. So this insidious soup, consisting of soot, sulfates, nitrates, ash, and what have you, was having a double whammy on the global dimming.
And when he looked at satellite images, Ramanathan found the same thing was happening all over the world. Over India, over China and extending into the Pacific, over Western Europe, extending into Africa, over the British Isles. But it was when scientists started to investigate the effects of global dimming that they made the most disturbing discovery of all. Those more reflective clouds could alter the pattern of the world's rainfall, with tragic consequences.
Dawn, and as the sun breaks through the piercing chill of night on the plain outside Koram, it lights up a biblical famine, now in the 20th century. This place, say workers here, is the closest thing to hell on earth.
The 1984 Ethiopian famine shocked the world. It was partly caused by a decades-long drought right across sub-Saharan Africa, a region known as the Sahel. For year after year, the summer rains failed. At the time, some scientists blamed overgrazing and poor land management. But now, there's evidence that the real culprit was global dimming. The Sahel's lifeblood has always been a seasonal monsoon. For most of the year, it is completely dry. But every summer, the heat of the sun warms the oceans north of the equator. This draws the rain belt that forms over the equator northwards, bringing rain to the Sahel. But for 20 years, in the 1970s and 80s, the tropical rain belt consistently failed to shift northwards, and the African monsoon failed. For climate scientists like Leon Rothstein, the disappearance of the rains had long been a puzzle. He could see that pollution from Europe and North America blew right across the Atlantic. But all the climate models suggested it should have little effect on the monsoon. But then Rothstein decided to find out what would happen if he took the Maldive findings into account.
What we found in our model was that when we allowed the pollution from Europe and North America to affect the properties of the clouds in the northern hemisphere, the clouds reflected more sunlight back to space, and this cooled the oceans of the northern hemisphere. And to our surprise, the result of this was that the tropical rain bands moved southwards, tracking away from the more polluted northern hemisphere towards the southern hemisphere.
Polluted clouds stopped the heat of the sun getting through. That heat was needed to draw the tropical rains northwards. So the life-giving rain belt never made it to the Sahel.
So what our model is suggesting is that these droughts in the Sahel in the 1970s and the 1980s may have been caused by pollution from Europe and North America affecting the properties of the clouds and cooling the oceans of the northern hemisphere.
Rothstein has found a direct link between global dimming and the Sahel drought. If his model is correct, it was what came out of our exhaust pipes and power stations that contributed to the deaths of 1 million people in Africa and afflicted 50 million more. This could be just a taste of what global dimming has in store.
The Sahel is just one example of the monsoon system. Let me take you to another part of the world, Asia, where the same monsoon brings rainfall to 3.6 billion people, roughly half the world's population. My main concern is this air pollution and the global dimming will also have a detrimental impact on this Asian monsoon. We are not talking about few millions of people, we are talking about few billions of people.
For Ramanathan, the implications are clear.
There is no choice here. We have to cut down air pollution, if not eliminate it altogether.
Fortunately, tackling air pollution needn't be too difficult. It wouldn't mean giving up on oil and coal altogether. We just have to burn them more cleanly. And in Europe, we've already made a start. Scrubbers in power stations, catalytic converters in cars and low-sulfur fuels, though they do nothing to reduce greenhouse gases, have already begun to cut down visible air pollution. This should be good news for the Sahel. And in recent years, the droughts have been nothing like as bad. But there's a terrible catch. Because while global dimming is itself a major threat to humanity, it now appears it has been protecting us from an even greater threat. Which means that as we reduce the dimming, we may find ourselves faced by something even worse.
You're listening to the audio soundtrack of Global Dimming, a movie made for the BBC and presented on September the 18th, 2006.
It was David Travis who first caught a glimpse of what the world could be like without global dimming. It happened in those chaotic days following the tragedy of 9/11. For 15 years, Travis had been studying the vapor trails, or contrails, left behind by high-flying aircraft. Though each individual contrail seems small, when they all spread out, they can blanket the sky.
Here are some examples of what we call outbreaks of contrails. These are large clusters of contrails, and here's a particularly good one from Southern California. Here's the west coast of the United States. And you can see here this lacing network of contrails covering at least 50%, if not 75% or more, of the sky in that area. It doesn't take an expert to realize that if you look at the satellite picture and see this kind of contrail coverage, that they've got to be having an effect on temperature at the surface.
But the problem Travis faced was to establish exactly how big an effect the contrails were actually having. The only way to do that was to find a period of time when, although conditions were right for contrails to form, there were no flights. And of course, that never happened. Until September 2001. Then, for 3 days after the 11th, virtually all commercial aircraft in the US were grounded. It was an opportunity Travis could not afford to miss. He set about gathering temperature records from all over the USA.
And initially, data from over 5,000 weather stations across the 48 United States, the areas that were most dominantly affected by the grounding.
Travis was not looking just at temperature. That varies a lot from day to day anyway. Instead, he focused on something that normally only changes quite slowly, the temperature range. The difference between the highest temperature during the day and the lowest at night. Had this changed at all during the 3 days of the grounding?
As we began to look at the climate data and the evidence began to grow, I got more and more excited. The actual results were much larger than I expected. So here we see for the three-day period preceding September 11th, a slightly negative value of temperature range with lots of contrails as normal. Then we have the sudden spike right here of the three-day period. This reflects lack of clouds, lack of contrails on warmer days, cooler nights, exactly what we expected, but even larger than we expected. So what this indicates is that during this three-day period, we had a sudden drop in global dimming contributed from airplanes.
During the grounding, the temperature range jumped by over a degree Celsius. Travis had never seen anything like it before.
This was the largest temperature swing of this magnitude in the last 30 years.
If so much could happen in such a short time, removing just one form of pollution, then it suggests that the overall effect of global dimming on world temperatures could be huge.
The 9/11 study shows that if you remove a contributor to global dimming, jet contrails, just for a three-day period, we see an immediate response at the surface of temperature. Do the same thing globally, we might see a large-scale increase in global warming.
This is the real sting in the tail. Solve the problem of global dimming, and the world could get considerably hotter. And this is not just theory. It may already be happening. In Western Europe, the steps we have taken to reduce particle pollution have started to bear fruit in a noticeable improvement in air quality, and even a slight reduction in global dimming over the last few years. Yet at the same time, after decades in which they held steady, European temperatures have started rapidly to rise, culminating in the savage summer of 2003. Forest fires devastated Portugal. Glaciers melted in the Alps. And in France, people died by the thousand. Could this be the penalty of reducing global dimming without tackling the root cause of global warming?
We thought we live in a global warming world, but this is actually not right. We lived in a global warming plus a global dimming world. And now we are taking out global dimming. So we end up with a global warming world, which will be much worse than we thought it will be, much hotter.
This is the crux of the problem. While the greenhouse effect has been warming the planet, it now seems global dimming has been cooling it down. So the warming caused by carbon dioxide has been hidden from us by the cooling from air pollution. But that situation is now starting to change.
We're going to be in a situation, unless we act, where the cooling pollutant is dropping off while the warming pollutant is going up. CO2 will be going up and particles will be dropping off. And that means we'll get an accelerated warming. We'll get a double whammy. We'll get reducing cooling and increased heating at the same time, and that's a problem for us.
And that's not all. Climatologists like Peter Cox have begun to worry that global dimming has led them to underestimate the true power of global warming. They fear that the Earth could be far more vulnerable to greenhouse gases than they had previously thought.
Two competing effects, really, that we've got the greenhouse effect, which has tended to warm up the climate, but then we've got this other effect that's much stronger than we thought, which is a cooling effect that comes from particles in the atmosphere. and they're competing with one another. And we know the climate's moved to a warmer state by about 0.6 of a degree over the last 100 years. So the whole thing's moved this way. If it turns out that the cooling is stronger than we thought, then the warming also is a lot stronger than we thought. And that means the climate's more sensitive to carbon dioxide than we originally thought. And it means our models may be undersensitive to carbon dioxide.
The models that everyone has been using to forecast climate change predict a maximum warming of 5 degrees by the end of the century. But Cox and his colleagues now fear those models may be wrong. Temperatures could rise twice as fast as they previously thought, with irreversible damage just 25 years away.
If we don't do anything by about 2030, we could have a global warming of exceeding 2 degrees, and at that point, it's believed the Greenland ice sheet would start to melt in a way that you wouldn't be able to stop it once it started. It would melt. Take a long time to melt, but ultimately it would lead to sea level rise 7 or 8 meters.
Once the Greenland ice cap begins to melt, nothing will stop it. Many of the world's major cities will be living on borrowed time. Decade by decade, the risk of catastrophic flooding would increase inexorably. But unless action is taken, it won't stop there. Because after Greenland, the world's tropical rainforests will start to wither in the heat.
2040 could be 4 degrees warmer. The climate change could have led to a big drying, particularly in the Amazon basin. That would make the forest unsustainable. We'd expect the forest to catch fire, probably, turn into savanna, and maybe ultimately even desert if it gets really, really dry, as our model suggests.
And as the rainforest burnt away, it would release vast amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, driving global warming still further. Cox calculates that in just a century, the world could be 10 degrees hotter, a warming more rapid than any in Earth history. If this were to happen, the landscape of England would be utterly transformed.
We're talking about a change from a lush, moist climate environment like this to a North African climate in just a few decades or 100 years.
Most British plant species could not survive a North African climate. With vegetation dying everywhere, soil erosion would become a severe problem. From a green and pleasant land, England would become a country of extremes, with winter flooding giving way to summer dust storms. And it would be far worse elsewhere.
You can imagine 10 degree warming in the UK in 100 years is catastrophic. 10 degree warming in a hot country already makes it essentially uninhabitable.
And just when one might think things could get no worse, in the far north, a 10 degree warming might be enough to release a vast natural store of greenhouse gas, bigger than all the oil and coal reserves of the planet.
we will be in danger of destabilizing these things called methane hydrates, which store a lot of methane at the bottom of the ocean in a kind of frozen form. 10,000 billion tons of the stuff, and they are known to be destabilized by warming.
At this point, whatever we did to curb our emissions, it would be too late. 10,000 billion tons of methane, a greenhouse gas 8 times stronger than carbon dioxide, would be released into the atmosphere. The Earth's climate would be spinning out of our control, heading towards temperatures unseen in 4 billion years. But this is not a prediction. It is a warning. It is what will happen if we clean up pollution while doing nothing about greenhouse gases. However, the easy solution, just keep on polluting and hope that global dimming will protect us, would be suicidal.
If we carried on pumping out the particles, it would have terrible impacts on human health. I mean, particles are involved in all sorts of respiratory diseases. That's why they're being brought under control. And of course, they affect climate anyway. If you fiddle with the balance of the planet, the radius of balance of the planet, you affect all sorts of circulation patterns like monsoons, which would have horrible effects on people. So it would be extremely difficult, in fact impossible, to cancel out the greenhouse effect just by carrying on pumping out particles, even if it wasn't for the fact that particles are damaging to human health.
Instead, we have to take urgent action to tackle the root cause of both global warming and global dimming: the burning of coal, oil, and gas. We may have to make very difficult choices about how we live and how we generate our electricity. We have been talking about such things for 20 years, but so far, very little has been done in practical terms. The discovery of global dimming makes it clear that we are rapidly running out of time.
One of the real driving forces is that you leave an environment that is comfortable for your children. And if we carry on going the way we're going, we're not going to do that. We're going to leave an environment that's much worse than the environment we lived in, and it will be down to what we did while we were using that environment. And that would be tragic, really, if that happened.
You've been listening to Global Dimming, a special made for the BBC and presented on September 18th, 2006.